So if somebody made you name three American performance cars, one of your guesses would be the Corvette. You might also get the Mustang, probably throw the Camaro in there for good measure. But the Corvette is the ultimate American performance car. It's the longest lived, it's the highest flying, it's the one that strayed the least from its roots for the longest amount of time. But for all of the Corvette's greatness, 45 years into its life, the only factory-backed racing car called a Corvette wasn't even a Corvette. It was the Corvette GTP, which is a full-on prototype racer with kind of modest Corvette styling. But finally, in 1999, all of that changed. And this is the story of that car, which is one of the greatest GT races of all time, the Chevrolet Corvette C5R. All right, guys, welcome back to the Race Car Podcast. It's been a while. I think I'm probably about 3 weeks out from the Hudson Hornet episode. Might be four at this point. I honestly haven't paid much attention. A lot of stuff going on, and I did a lot of work on this one. So usually I write something like 2,500. I think the Audi episode was like 2,800 words. I've written about 4,500 words for this episode. So the Corvette, you know, I'm American, so the Corvette is an important car for me. I'm not even necessarily a big Corvette fanboy. It's just, it's good to see an American car run by an American team out there in world motorsport dominating their class and generally doing things the American way, which I appreciate. So, Chevrolet Corvette C5R, let's get into it. So, while the Corvette really doesn't have a factory-backed racing history, it does have a rich racing history. And that history dates all the way back to the man that a lot of people refer to as the father of the Corvette, Zora Arkas Duntov. Though, me personally, I prefer to go through the Yondu from Guardians of the Galaxy definition, and to me that makes Zora, more accurately, the daddy of the Corvette, because its father, its inventor, was Harley Earl, who was the head of styling at GM in 1953 and convinced his bosses to build the car. But back to Zora Arkas Duntov, though, he was born in Belgium. He escaped France just ahead of the Nazi occupation of World War II, and that was when he came to America. So after a stint as a business owner, and then he went to England to work with sports car maker Allard, Arkas Duntov came to work for GM in 1953 after seeing the original Motorama Corvette. While he loved the look of the car, he was less enthusiastic about the meager inline six under its hood. To that end, he wrote a memo to his bosses, which was called, quote, "Thoughts Pertaining to Youth, Hot Rodders, and Chevrolet." In the memo, he described his ideas for stealing the budding hot rodding segment from Ford. By 1957, his attitude had led him to become Chevrolet's director of high-performance vehicles. Unfortunately for Arkas Duntov, also in 1957, GM signed the Automobile Manufacturer Association's Gentlemen's Agreement to not compete in motorsports. This was a reaction to the Le Mans disaster of 1955. So, without going too far into it, in short, Pierre Levet rear-ended Lance Macklin's Austin Healey. Levet, who was in a magnesium-bodied Mercedes, went up over the back of Macklin's car at 120 miles an hour, over a berm, and into the spectator area. 83 spectators and Levet were killed, 180 more were injured. Mercedes actually withdrew from motor racing entirely for 30 years as a result, and the incident nearly doomed motorsports worldwide. In fact, Switzerland actually still has a ban on motorsports, except for motorsports involving electric vehicles to this very day. And the bit about electrics was only put in 2015. Anyway, I told you all that to tell you that Zora Arkas Duntov couldn't simply get factory backing and go racing. He had actually been trying to right up to the ban. That gentleman's agreement took effect in June of 1957. Chevrolet had competed in the 1957 12 Hours of Sebring in March and were planning to race Le Mans with the C1 Corvette SS when the ban took them out of it. Zora made another attempt at a serious Corvette racer in 62 with the Grand Sport. That project was actually a direct response to the AC Shelby Cobra, which of course was associated with Ford. Actually, funny thing about the Cobra, Carroll Shelby had approached GM first about power for the Cobra, but GM didn't want to create competition for the Corvette, so they passed on the project. But then the Corvette, of course, got that competition anyway when Shelby then went with Ford. Arkas Duntov planned a full 125-car run to homologate it for international competition, but GM was apparently more serious than Ford was about staying out of motorsports because they killed the Grand Sport after only five were produced. which is really a shame about that, because they put it in an all-aluminum 377-cubic-inch V8 with four 58-millimeter Weber side drafts on it, which is an awesome-looking setup, and it made really good power, 500-550 horsepower or so. And also, the single coolest-looking thing that you can put it on an engine is velocity stacks. And the more velocity stacks you have, the cooler your engine was. So the 377 had eight of them, which makes it an extremely cool engine. In fact, my former Pontiac J2000 race car had four velocity stacks on a pair of Delorto DHLA40s, so velocity stacks even briefly made a GM J-body cool. After the Grand Sport, though, we had 37 years of really kinda nothing. John Greenwood ran his pretty radical C3 Corvettes, but there was no factory backing there. It was also a tube chassis race car by 1976. It really wasn't Corvette-based, it was wearing a Corvette suit. Reeves Callaway brought a trio of supernatural C4 Corvettes to Le Mans in 1995 after having a single car disqualified in 94. I think it ran out of fuel on track or something like that, but he didn't compete in the top GT class. The cars, however, did finish second and third in LMGT2, so pretty decent effort by Reeves Callaway and his guys. So, kind of as an aside, I'm considering adding a segment to the show. In fact, I've already decided to add it at this point, but it's going to be called 6 Degrees of Stretzel, where I link whatever car I'm talking about to Hans J. Stuck in under 6 moves. This would be an easy one, because that 95 Callaway was driven by Frank Jelinski, who teamed with Stuck at Audi for the 1990 DTM Championship. But, here's the one for the Hudson Hornet episode. So, Stuck teamed with Danny Sullivan at Le Mans in 1994. And Danny Sullivan apparently drove like one NASCAR race for Jim Matty Racing. Jim Matty Racing was formerly known as Jeff Bodine Racing. Jeff Bodine raced for Junior Johnson. Junior Johnson fielded a car for Curtis Turner in some races in 1966. Turner also drove for Smokey Unick, who crew-chiefed the fabulous Hudson Hornet. I could have actually even gone one shorter on that, because Turner drove a Hornet in 1952. So for this segment, I'm actually really looking forward to the Auto Union episode, because that's going to be a real quick one. So Doug Rippey built a C4 ZR1 racer for Le Mans in 1995, and he intended to run it in GT1, which was the top GT class, and it did not go well. The car started the race last, the engine failed after 4 laps, and it would only run about 3 hours total in the 24-hour race. They had brought 3 engines with them. One had already failed fairly spectacularly in qualifying, and the last was kind of a detuned motor. So they had to spend a bunch of time rebuilding the other race motor. Surprisingly, this car actually used the ZR1's 32-valve V8 as the base for the race motor, which made just a little bit less power than that quad Weber 377 that was in the Grand Sport. So, after that, another 3 years passed before the event that finally made GM relent, which was the 1997 introduction of the fifth-generation Corvette, known as the C5.
Speed 170, still climbing.
Does anybody have any idea what this is?
I do.
Well?
It's the next Vette.
So, with the introduction of the C5, GM had decided that they were serious about the car being competitive as a sports car on the world stage. Not good for an American car, but great full stop. Not willing to just trade on name, they wanted to go and do the damn thing. Unfortunately for GM, Porsche and Chrysler were already out there doing the damn thing. So, look, if you're listening to the show, I probably don't need to tell you about Porsche and Le Mans. Audi won Le Mans overall 13 times in 15 years, and for all that, they still trailed Porsche by 3 at the time, and now it's 6, because Porsche just went back and casually won the race 3 more times, just because they felt like it. So that's not even to mention the non-overall class wins. So if you're going to go sports car racing, Porsche is a thing you're going to have to deal with, and you need to accept that. It'll look vaguely like a squash Beetle, there'll be a flat 6 somewhere inside it, and it'll probably be faster and better than whatever you have built. Now, all that said, GM lucked out a little bit because they were not getting a Porsche at its apex. Their car at the time was the 993 generation Porsche GT2, which is the original 911 GT2. It's It's an absolutely mad car. It had an air-cooled flat six turbo, made 430 horsepower in road trim, had these big fat fenders, giant wing. To a lot of people, this is the Porsche 911. In fact, just thinking about it, it's the car that my brain conjures whenever I think of a Porsche 911. So I go directly to the 993. So the 993 GT2 is really an iconic vehicle. Porsche debuted the GT2 at Le Mans in 95, and they won the class with it in 96 and 97. It ended up, by the end, somewhat underpowered for its class, but the Porsche did remain competitive in the hands of teams like Rook Racing and Liberé Competition for 1998, finishing as high as third in their class. I would say you probably don't need to feel very badly for Porsche, though, because while the 911 GT2 was getting past it, the 911 GT1 had won its class on debut in 96 and Le Mans overall in 1998. Oh, by the way, the guy driving the 911 GT1 for its class debut win in 1996, Hans J. Stuck, because, you know, it's a thing. It's going to be in every episode. I like Hans Stuck. It's whatever. So I said the 911 GT2 was at the end of its career and it was down on power, and the car that was taking its lunch money at Le Mans by 1998 was the Chrysler Viper. Quick programming note, I'm an American. I will be going back and forth between calling the car a Chrysler or a Dodge. I apologize for that. It's a Dodge Viper to me, and it always will be, but at Le Mans, they were Chryslers. So I'll try my best to call it a Chrysler, but I make zero promises that I will call it a Chrysler. Anyway, the major inspiration for the Viper was the Corvette's earlier competitor, the Cobra. And for the Cobra, it took being rebodied into the Cobra Daytona to make the car truly competitive and winning international racer on the biggest stages. And the same thing basically happened to the Viper. If you look, when the car was introduced in 1992, the Viper was a two-seat roadster with a removable target top. It had side pipes. It really looked like a modern, you know, like the 427 Shelby Cobras, the later ones. But the Viper that we saw at Le Mans was an altogether different looking car. And that's because it was the Viper GTSR. So in place of that open top, you know, where the had like a targa bar behind it, just kind of ended. So instead, there was kind of a sleek coupe body that was lifted almost totally from the Cobra Daytona. Look at pictures of them side by side if you can't see the inspiration there. It's, you know, fortunately, not a ton had to change under the hood, and the engine was left intact. Where Porsche went to battle with a 3.6-liter turbo flat six, Dodge, Chrysler, decided there was really no replacement for displacement, and they put an 8-liter V10 in the car. That's 488 cubic inches if you're scoring along at home. The Viper made 620 horsepower or so, which actually meant its specific output was pretty low, 77.64 horsepower per liter. I just bought a 2003 Audi Allroad with a 2.7T, and that car makes 92 and change horsepower per liter. But this works in the Viper's favor at endurance events because the engine isn't really stressed. They're not making it do a ton of work like the Porsche was. The car was developed and run in partnership with Reika, though Reynard did a lot of the initial prep work on the cars after receiving them from Chrysler. The car ran an LM GT1 in 1996, where it competed against the Porsche 911 GT1 and the McLaren F1, and it didn't really fare all that well. But in 1997, the car dropped to LM GT2, which is where it started its rivalry with the Porsche 911. Porsche took the top four spots in 97 before the first Viper, but in 98, a rake of Vipers finished first and second in their class. Viper's domination only increased in 1999 when Vipers took the top six spots in what was now called LMGTS. So this is the landscape that GM was bringing Corvette into. Their single biggest competitor, the Viper, was absolutely dominating the field, and Porsche, they were more or less like the gatekeeper that you'd have to beat to even get a shot at the Viper. When GM announced the C5 in 1996, they also created Corvette Racing right alongside it. So this is the official GM Corvette race team. And GM tapped their racing director, Herb Fischel, to go out and find a guy to lead it. And he found Doug Feehan. So Doug got his start racing a showroom stock Mustang for Ford's SVO division. And he actually brought Mack Tools into racing for the first time as a sponsor. So anytime you see Mack Tools in motorsports, you have Doug Feehan to thank for it. He then became Mack's director of racing before being taken by Fischel to GM's racing department. Fischel hoped Doug could tell them why they weren't having any great success in IMSA at the time. So Doug bounced around a little bit, various GM projects. He worked on the Beretta Trans Am series in 1990, where he produced a championship for Tommy Kendall. He moved to the Intrepid GTP, which is a ridiculous-looking, like, slab-sided... it was a GTP car, so the idea that they had was, well, we're just going to make a ton of power, we're going to make a ton of drag on the car, and we're just going to maximize the downforce. So when the car was working, it was insanely fast, really high cornering speeds, broke a lot. But, you know, when it worked, it worked. You could probably call that project a modest success. From the Intrepid, he went to work on Oldsmobile's 1996 WSC Championship with Riley and Scott. So, basically, Doug Feehan had done some stuff. Herb Fischel wanted to win Le Mans. He thought the C5 was the car, he thought Doug Feehan was the guy, but GM didn't want to go public with it yet. So, Feehan enlisted Pratt and Miller to develop the car. They were to take a factory stock C5, turn it into a race winner. If Pratt and Miller could convince Feehan and Fischel that the C5 was capable, and if GM felt that their program could be a success, they would fund the Corvette racing program. Fortunately for Pratt and Miller, the C5 was a far superior base from which to fight the Viper and the 911 than previous Corvettes were. The first advantage of the C5 is that the chassis was a hydroformed box frame. Hydroforming allowed complex shapes to be made in the frame in a way that die stamping doesn't. It also allows for a higher stiffness to weight ratio, and since we're talking about race cars, you want stiffness and you want a low weight, so that's just a big win. A second major change that GM had made on the C5 was to move the gearbox to the rear, which formed a transaxle at the back. This actually gave the C5 perfect 50-50 weight distribution, where the C4 was about 52 front, 48 rear, somewhere in that ballpark. The C4 also apparently has a tendency towards snap oversteer when pushed at the limit, which is generally not what you want, and the C5 was a much more predictable car. Third, and probably the most important development with the C5, was it was the home of an engine that has, over the last 25 years or so, become one of the most raced engines of all time, which is the GM Gen 3 small block V8, which we all know as the LS. So here's what you do. Go and look at the street out in front of your house. Or if you're driving around, just look out the window. Look at whatever cars are driving past you or sitting out there. The odds are somebody has LS swapped whatever car it is that you're looking at. So E30 BMWs, LS swapped. FD Mazda RX-7s, LS swapped. A Saab 92X. You remember that thing, the WRX wearing a Saab costume? Yeah, I found on the internet where somebody LS swapped a Saab 92X for... I don't know why, I'm just glad it happened. There's no cheaper, easier, or more reliable horsepower than an LS V8. So the LS debuted in 5.7-liter displacement, but the initial C5R engine was 6 liters. Compared to a street engine block, the C5R block features a lot of trick engineering. So it was cast in 356M aluminum, and the C5R block is heat-treated and hipped. I had no idea what hipping was. I had to look it up. So I just discovered as I was writing this that hipping is a process where the block is pressurized, heated, and cooled in a specific way, which enhances strength and almost totally eliminates porosity. 20% of all the C5R blocks which are hipped fail inspection afterwards, and that's inspection performed via X-ray. Additionally, the block features a lot of extra ribbing to increase its stiffness. The block in the C5 is actually a stressed member of the chassis. There's like this big aluminum plate at the front of it that goes between the block and the accessory drive, and that's what ties it into the chassis. So they really had to overbuild the engine block. It was also intended to make over 750 naturally aspirated horsepower, which, you know, you can't make an engine out of paper mache and expect it to take that. Billet bearing caps, a line-honed cam and crankshaft journals. They didn't use bolts, it was studs for everything. And the block was actually, you can take it all the way out to 440 cubic inches, you can make them make 900 horsepower, and you can actually buy a C5R block new from General Motors if you wanted. When they first came out, they were about $6,000, now they're $9,000. So I guess this is just, if you ran out of ways to spend money on your project car, you know, spend $9,000 on a C5R engine block, why not? Initially, GM thought those 6 liters would be sufficient because of the way in which the FIA balanced engines. So the 8-liter Viper would be restricted. It would have an actual airflow restrictor going into the motor, and the Corvette's restrictor would be larger. It would allow it to pass more air through. But ultimately, displacement would win out, and Corvette would make use of 427 of the block's available cubic inches. Pratt & Miller built a development mule from a 96 C5, which is right off the assembly line. And something I actually had never thought of about this was that the hardtop C5, which is what we think of as the performance one, wasn't introduced until 1999. So the C5 was based on the conventional coupe vet body. Even once the lighter hardtop body came out, the C5 retained its coupe bodywork. The main advantage of the hardtop was weight savings, so I guess with Lexan windows being a thing on the C5R, aero was the larger concern, and the coupe rear shape must have done a better job getting air to the car's rear wing. Another big change, really maybe the single biggest change that they had to make to the C5 to make it a racer, was a Corvette hallmark had been a transverse leaf spring suspension for the rear end. And on the C5, or the C5R anyway, they did away with it. And the car actually went with just regular coil springs. So as much as we all love the the transverse leaf setup, you know, they recognized that it was just much easier to tune coils. And if you're going to build a race car, just let's not mess around. Let's put coils in the thing. Shockingly, though, that transverse leaf rear suspension would actually continue on through the C6 and C7 generations of Corvette. It was only with the newest C8 that they finally did away with it, because, you know, the mid-engine architecture of the C8 simply wouldn't allow for it. Anyway, so development of the car went on for 2 full years in secret. Canadian Ron Fellows and American Chris Knievel were the drivers. The car was unmarked, though I'm not entirely sure how that would have helped them. If somebody saw a GT spec Corvette running laps anywhere, questions would be asked no matter how the car was marked. I suppose in a little bit of an effort to maintain a little bit of anonymity, they towed the car in an unmarked fifth wheel trailer, and to try and throw people off of the factory scent, the rig was actually pulled by a Ford pickup. In late 97, while testing at Atlanta Motor Speedway, Knievel actually had a tire go down and put the car heavily into the wall. This was pretty poor timing, since the car was going to be shown to some GM executives the very next day, and this was the main test mule. But with the crash, they actually got to see firsthand how well the C5 structure would hold up to an accident, and were pleased by the results, so silver linings, I suppose. By the end of 98, GM felt that the car was ready to go and decided on its first race, the 1999 Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona. Because when you've never run a single lap with your brand newly developed race car, you may as well jump directly into the deep end. Now, as pessimistic as I sounded about it, Corvette Racing actually put the car second and third in class to start the race, behind the lead Arrayka Viper, and they would lead the majority of the race. Somewhere around the 20th hour, though, the lead car, which was the number 2, driven by Fellows, Knievel, and John Paul Jr., would suffer engine problems from sand getting into the motor and wearing the cylinder bores. Rook Racing would win the class with their 911 GT2, but clearly Corvette Racing had proved their concept. Fans were into it, response from Corvette owners was massively positive, and GM felt the car would become a winner. So, as far as the rest of 99, they ran both cars at Sebring, then one car going forward at Sears Point, Petit Le Mans, Laguna Seca, and Las Vegas. Corvette didn't take any wins in 99, but they were able to fight with Arrayka. When they competed, they generally only finished behind the Viper. But looking forward to Le Mans, Corvette had to make a lot of changes to the car at the request of the ACO to comply with their rules for Le Mans. But then the ACO just flatly rejected that car, even though Corvette Racing had done everything that they said to do, I guess because France. Doug Feehan had to tell GM to be cool, because they really thought the ACO was just messing with them, which they probably were. So I think the ACO wanted to see that they were serious, since the C4 Corvette entry into GT1 was half-baked, to say the least. And the ACO, in that case, was rather friendly, because they wanted to get that Corvette in there, because people loved hearing the V8s and stuff, and then the car was really just, it just did a whole lot of nothing. But the second version of the car was accepted by the ACO, which meant for 2000, Corvette was ready to return to Le Mans. They started the 2000 season at Daytona again, and while they were at 1.3 laps down to the leading Viper, they finished the race only 30 seconds behind over the course of 24 hours. The next race that they ran was Sebring, and Ron Fellows put the C5R on pole, but he suffered reliability issues. So after this race, I guess Corvette was, they finally made the decision to go to the 7-liter version of the engine, which their engine partner K-Tech had built, and they actually ran at Las Vegas in 99.
Corvette looks to technical partner K-Tech Engines to supply horsepower. Cylinder head and block design are done in-house by GM Racing, but overall development is done by K-Tech.
GM Racing has worked with K-Tech literally for years and years. This is not the first program by any stretch. They've had success in Trans Am, the Oldsmobile road racing program. That evolved into the four-valve Aurora V8 road racing program, which was done entirely here. Virtually all of the early Indy Racing League development was done here. Same thing. The cylinder head and block designed within General Motors. All of the development done here at K-Tech.
They'd be penalized with smaller restrictors, but they did find that they needed the extra torque to be able to compete with the 8-liter Viper. When it came time for Le Mans, Corvette actually was not the only GM factory effort there. Cadillac was competing with their short-lived Northstar LMP in the top class. That car, developed by Riley and Scott, was powered by a twin-turbo version of Cadillac's Northstar V8, which is not entirely true. It was actually based on the Oldsmobile version of the V8, which would be the 4-liter, and further, it was based on the version of that engine that they were using at the time in the Indy Racing League, although with twin turbos. But still, they called it a Northstar, and the Northstar LMP, as it was called, would achieve modest success, but no victories in its three active years. Le Mans was a success for Corvette. They finished third and fourth in class behind the Arrayca Vipers, and by this point, by the way, they were in what is now their traditional yellow paint scheme. The 64 car, driven by Andy Pilgrim, Frank Frion, and Kelly Collins, was the top car for Corvette that day, with their third in class finish translating to a 10th overall. It wasn't a victory, but it was a massive win for the team in regards to their future. This is really the race that made GM say, okay, let's stop messing around, let's go win this thing. And to that effect, after Le Mans, they started on effectively the real second-gen version of the C5R. While GM had initially wanted to stay as close to production as possible, that really ended after Le Mans with the introduction of the second-gen C5R. The next C5R was 3 inches wider than the previous car to take advantage of a new tire developed by partner Goodyear and also some suspension changes. Tubular steel upper and lower A-arms replaced the factory aluminum control arms. The fenders were flared, and the whole rear of the car's body was widened to accommodate the changes. Weight was also decreased by 100 pounds. With that second-gen car, Corvette would go to finish second at Mosport, which was a race the team wasn't even planning to compete in, but Ron Fellows convinced them to run his home race, where he guaranteed them a win. Unfortunately, caution towards the end of the race swung the victory to the Vipers, but it was very clear that for the first time, the Corvette was the better car and would have won the race on merit if not for a little bit of bad luck. After this, Corvette went to Texas. So this was another race that the team wasn't planning to run, but their sponsor, AER, was based in the area and thought it would be good for the sponsor, for Viper to run for Corvette to run their home race. Crazy hot conditions made life extremely difficult for Fellows and Andy Pilgrim. Apparently after his stint, Fellows stripped down to his underwear and got hosed down like a horse before getting back in to finish the race after an Andy Pilgrim double stint. Luckily, all the pain of the heat was worth it because Corvette would take their first victory over the Arrayca Viper by a margin of 3 laps. So clearly the balance of power in the class was finally shifting. But that was a sprint race. So Corvette would also get their first endurance win at Petit Le Mans that year. Andy Pilgrim pulling off a daring move on Viper's Tommy Archer on the last lap of the race. With it getting dark outside, Pilgrim was kind of banking on the fact that maybe Archer couldn't really see him all that well in his mirrors. So Pilgrim sold a dummy to the outside heading into turn one, which he had identified as really the place that this had to happen. With the big engine in the front, the Viper tended to wear its front tires late in races, would pick up a lot of understeer, so Archer was really having to slow way, way, way down for turn one. Pilgrim, like I said, he looked to the outside, and as soon as Archer braked, he just licked the stamp and sent the damn thing down the outside, or down the inside, rather. Archer, surprised by the move, slid off into the marbles, and Pilgrim was able to cruise on to a victory. So, unfortunately, at this point is where factory support for the Viper ends. It seemed maybe Chrysler had seen the writing on the wall in that they got what they came for. They didn't really want to develop the car any further, and they saw that the Corvette was coming. So, while it would have been nice to see more competition, By that point, the Corvette had caught and passed the Viper. 2001 started for Corvette with the Rolex 24, and that might actually be the Corvette's most famous race because they ran two cars, the number two car and the three. And while the two would win the race, the three car ran with a team of Andy Pilgrim, Kelly Collins, Dale Earnhardt, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. So while the two would actually be the winner and would win the event overall, the Earnhardts being involved brought massive amounts of fanfare and attention to what Corvette Racing was doing. And I guess Dale Sr. was smitten with the car.
I've talked about running the 24-hour race for a lot of years in Daytona. And Chevrolet and the Corvette guys came up with this deal last year, really, but we couldn't put it together because of my neck injuries and all. So this year was able to put it together. Now, this is a race car. This is a neat car to drive. And that's one thing that's great about it. I went down and tested the car, and I've got a Corvette that I drive around the street, but it's nothing as fancy, nothing to get up and go and also stop and turn as good as this race car does. And this is going to be a fun car to race in the 24-hour race, but a fun car and a great memory for me. Matter of fact, might even build a street car just like this to play with on the street. But this is, I think, an ultimate dream car right here.
He was in talks to start his own Corvette racing team. He was actually having a replica of the car built for himself. And he and Junior were going to run Le Mans when he tragically lost his life at the Daytona 500 a few weeks later. So 2001, though, is the year that Corvette would finally get their Le Mans win, with the team of Ron Fellows, Johnny O'Connell, and Scott Pruitt taking the victory. And that's really the point at which the C5R becomes something of a dominant force in their class. They weren't entirely uncontested, so they won the ALMS Championship, the 12 Hours of Sebring, Le Mans again in 2002, and then the Pro Drive Ferrari team would show up, which would give them a little bit of a challenge. They competed with Corvette in the ALMS, and Pro Drive would actually take a Le Mans victory away from Corvette in 2003. That one stung for Corvette. They painted the cars blue, white, and red instead of their traditional yellow, and numbered them 50 and 53 instead of their regular 63 and 64. 50 for 50 years of Corvette, 53 being the first year of the Corvette. And I guess they couldn't run 53 before because that was usually an Arrayco Viper number. ProDrive would win the class with their Ferrari 550 GTS Maranello, and they actually beat the Corvettes by 10 laps. In 2004, ProDrive withdrew from ALMS, allowing the Corvette to literally sweep the season. And while they returned to Le Mans to fight with Corvette Racing again that year, they would finish behind both Corvettes, who won the GTS class. The C5R's last event ever came that year at Laguna Seca, which was the Monterey Sports Car Championships. Corvette would place first and second in class, because at this point, that's just what the Corvette did. Just a couple other things, I couldn't really find a spot to put them in. Just various changes that were made on the cars over the year. In 2001, they changed, I guess, where they were fuel, where they put the fuel in to make for faster pit stops. They also changed from a 5-speed gearbox to a 6-speed, I think, in 2002. Eventually, in 2004, they would run a transmission from X-Track, which I think was, a regular sequential box. Originally, the car had a regular 5-speed H-pattern box. Early on, they'd be using BBS wheels. They'd switch to OZ. They made a lot of aerodynamic changes later on, stuff, under the floor, different ducting, new engine intakes, all that stuff. It really did take quite a lot of development for the car to stay on top for as long as it did. And because of all that development, the numbers that the C5R would finish its career with are gaudy. 55 races entered, 50 podiums, 31 wins, 24 pole positions. They would get 4 team championships, 4 constructor championships, and 3 driver championships. And probably more importantly than that, after all of this time where we didn't have a factory Corvette racing effort, we've now had 22 years consecutively of Corvette racing factory back effort. And, what GM did, what they set out to do, the C5R became a Le Mans winner. Its successor, the C6R, Le Mans winner. C7R, Le Mans winner. the C8, I'm sure, will be a Le Mans winner in the next few years because that's what they do. They develop the car, they go out, and they win. So while it took a little bit of time and, if I'm honest, probably more effort than GM thought that it was going to take, they did get what they wanted. They got their Le Mans champion, their world champion, their dominant sports car. But it was literal years of work, research, and dedication that led to it. This was a car that was developed into a champion. It's not something that caught lightning in a bottle so much as, you know, like if you go back to my first episode, the Brabham BT52, that, yeah, Gordon Murray, you know, he developed the car and all that stuff. But it really was like, okay, well, what if we just do this? And that just, you know, just for 1 year, it just killed everybody. So the C5R, it was just work. You know, it just went on and on and on. And the car just got better and better and better. So I think that pretty much does it for me for the C5R, since I really don't want this to be an hour-long episode. Next episode, I decide I am finally going to go back to Formula One, and we're going to talk about what I believe is the best-looking Formula One car of all time, which is the Gary Anderson-designed Jordan 191, which means that we got to talk a little bit of Schumacher, I'm going to talk a little bit of Alex Zanardi, Gary Anderson, and most importantly, probably, we get to talk about Eddie Jordan, that absolute madman. So, thanks for listening, guys. You can hit me up on Twitter with any suggestions. If you want to shoot me an email instead, racecarpodcast@gmail.com, Twitter, @racecarpodcast, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it'll probably be a little while before the next episode. Hopefully not 4 weeks to a month like this one took, but we'll see how it goes. I already started writing the 191 script, so we'll see where that takes me, but... I say, guys, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.